Hello, and welcome to Openly Gamer Theater's production of The Stygian Fragment, a Call of Cthulhu roleplay drama.
This is Mike, and I'm playing Father Evan Daniel Leary.
Hello, this is Dan, and I am playing Phineas Lockwood.
This is Brandon. I'll be playing Clarence Rouse.
This is Shannon. I'm playing Julia Margaret Barnes.
This is Jason. I'm playing Jack Houston Smith.
And I'm Sean. I'm playing Robert Lewis Covington.
Be warned, the following content may not be suitable for all audiences.
While Rouse and I waited in his office for the taxi that Betty called for, we worked out our next step in the investigation. We only had a few hours until we were to meet up with the others at the plaza. The plan was to make sure that we were on the same page before going to the Falstaff Mansion.
One of the other newspaper clippings, as I mentioned to Falstaff, I was kind of trying to gauge his reaction to seeing whether or not he was involved or knew anything about it. One of the newspaper clippings we found in Dorian's room mentioned the Gedicke brothers. Leonard Price Jr. was kidnapped. He's a 16-year-old boy who's kidnapped. He is the son of the owners of the National Candy Company. He was last seen at the factory site on Gravois. The Gedicke brothers are working on that site.
How long ago was this kidnapping?
Earlier this month.
Oh. All right.
I guess we could use some of your police connections.
Yeah, I was saying, let me call down to the station, see what they know before we head out there and ruffle some feathers.
He got on his phone and was soon talking to the detective working on the Price kidnapping case. Rouse's face soured when he heard the voice on the other end. Apparently, he and this guy had a history. Clarence later told me that Vernon Mann was a real flat tire and absolutely hated him.
Mann.
Hey, detective, this is Clarence Rouse. How you been?
Rouse, what have you been doing with yourself?
Drunk.
Uh-huh.
You're working the Price case?
Yeah.
What kind of progress are you making? You know anything?
What's it to you?
It's just a little case I'm working. Just trying to see what I can find out before I go talk with them. I don't want to upset them.
Someone hired you to work the Price kid case?
It's tough to believe, isn't it?
All right, I'll bite. What do we know? Dad went to the build site for a meeting with the construction company. Took Junior with him. Kid waits in the car. Chauffeur interrupts the meeting, stating the kid went to take a leak and never came back. Only evidence is the kid's hat, found by the fence. Because of the nearby rail yard, we shook up a couple of tramps. Nobody knows nothing. Kid just vanished.
Wow, that's good. That's good police work. I knew all that from the paper.
Alright, smart guy. You know something that I don't?
I will soon enough.
Don't go harassing the Prices. And don't ever call me again.
What'd you find out?
Oh, well, we found out they're near the rail yard. They don't know anything. We could head out, talk to the family.
We took the cab to the Price family home on Forsyth, a real affluent area of the city a few blocks west of Forest Park. Rouse had the cabbie keep the meter running. He didn't expect to get let in, much less take long. When the maid answered the door, I flashed my press credentials in her face and asked to see Mr. Price regarding the kidnapping of Leonard Jr. She closed the door in our faces. Just when we are about to turn around and get back in the cab, she opened the door and invited us in. We both stood just inside the foyer in total surprise when Leonard Price Sr. came out of a side room. My first impression of him, was that this dapper, with his tight style and elegant manner, looked like what every drugstore cowboy wished that they could pull off.
Mr. Rouse and Miss Barnes.
Mr. Price, nice to meet you. Sorry for your loss. Julia here is doing a piece. We're maybe trying to shed some light on this kidnapping where the police have failed.
I see. Please, come into my office.
Thank you.
We followed him into the room behind him, a rather lavish office. Rouse and I took seats as he closed the door.
I'm not sure if you can find out more than the police have, but at this juncture, I'm willing to try anything.
The corners of his mouth tightened slightly. I could tell he was restraining pent-up emotions, composing himself, hiding behind decorum. Price motioned toward an ornate liquor cabinet set into the far wall.
Would you like a drink?
No, thank you.
What do you have?
Scotch?
Scotch, please. Thank you. You're not my mom.
He handed Rouse a half-full malt glass and leaned against the corner of his desk.
Do you have any information about my son?
Not really. I'm trying to, and forgive me for bringing up anything that's painful, but is there anything you can remember about that day? What can you walk through your steps?
He pursed his lips in thought, manicured index finger, idly tapping the rim of his glass, causing the amber liquid to bounce.
I had a 9:30 meeting with Mr. Norton, my architect, as well as Stanley Gedeke at the site of my new factory. While I was inside, Junior waited in the car with my chauffeur. He needed to relieve himself and walked behind a brick pile. James, my chauffeur, went to look for him after he didn't return, and he was gone.
What can you tell me about your son and be the type to run off?
Oh no, Leo is a very intelligent and well-mannered boy.
Your driver, he worked for you very long?
Decades. His family has worked for mine for generations.
So I'm assuming he's still employed with you.
He is.
Price sniffed, put his glass to his lips, and took a deep pull. Then he looked at me, unable to mask the pain in his eyes this time.
The police are telling us that it is likely a transient took my son. We've offered a $10,000 reward, but still nothing.
You've not... What? I'm sorry, Julia. You've not received a ransom demand?
No. That is why the police are saying that they suspect a vagrant may have taken him.
What can you tell me about your work with the... Or rather, their work with you, of the Gedeke brothers?
Oh. I hired them based on their reputation. They are known for efficient and stable work.
Did they have any sort of security on the site?
Yes. There is always security on a construction site, guarding tools, supplies.
Did any of the security people... Did it seem like there were a superfluous amount of security?
I really don't know. There seemed an appropriate amount, I suppose. I trust those that I hire to get the job done. I'm not in the construction business, nor security. I pay them to do that.
Make a no roll.
Yeah! I need an 85 or less. 66!
Right then it clicked. I had seen Price's face before, when I first came to town. Shortly after I claimed my inheritance from my uncle's estate, I began nosing my way into St. Louis society. Circles that I knew Cindy was involved with, doing what I could to get information on the black-veiled prophet. There was an article in the Post, several years ago, about Price and the society. I began flipping backwards through my notebook.
While she's looking through her notebook for God knows what, can I get a refresher on my scotch?
Sure. You seem like a single malt man.
I'm an any kind of malt man, yes, sir.
I continued to scan my old notes as Clarence kept Price talking.
Your meeting was presumably during the middle of the day?
In the morning, yes.
With dozens of workers around, I imagine?
Yes, it was really windy that morning, so we parked away from most of the work, off the north end of the site, to avoid some of the grit that was getting on the car.
Could he be easily overpowered?
I suppose. He isn't overly fit, if that's what you mean. Certainly no weakling, though.
It was windy that day. I guess that would make it hard to hear him yell if the wind was blowing the correct way.
No one heard a thing.
I imagine the police have spoke to your driver.
At length. I trust James. He is heartbroken.
Mr. Price, I remember seeing your name in the paper before. Something to do with some societal thing.
My wife and I aren't much for social activities, though we have been known to go to a few charity functions.
I think it was the Black Veil Prophet?
His hand stopped, mid-sip. There it was. A real reaction.
Well, you have a good memory, Miss Barnes. That article was written several years ago.
Newspapers are what I do.
I see. Yes. I was asked to join the society. I declined.
Price's brows furrowed. I could see the wheels turning. He was piecing something together.
When I did so, I was told...
Then his eyes widened.
I was told to rethink my position. To consider my family.
When did this happen?
2 years ago.
I looked at his hand, the one holding his drink. It shook slightly.
That son of a...
Is this guy upset enough about his son being missing?
Yeah, it looks like he's about to drop his drink. And he shakes and sets the glass down. And you see him put his hand on his desk as if to keep himself up.
Price began to tremble with emotion. I stood up and stepped beside him, placing a comforting hand on his shoulder. He absently looked at my hand, then up into my eyes.
How did you know to ask about that?
I actually have a bit of an interest in the Black Veil Prophet. Do you remember the fire that happened 7 years ago?
In the cave, I've heard stories.
That is ultimately what we are investigating.
And that led to me and my son.
Yes.
Do you think they are connected?
Yes. Is the Gedeki family part of the Black Veil Prophet?
Maybe. If they are, they would be rank-and-file members. They don't have the breeding for anything higher than that.
Who asked you to join?
Oliver Laclede. It was not long after I took over the company from my father. I attended a dinner party where he asked me to join. As I said, I declined. I could tell that it angered him.
What prompted you to decline such an invitation?
Price stared at his hands, clearly not wanting to tell us anything more. From my notebook, I pulled out the picture of Cindy and showed it to him. Confusion momentarily crossed his face as he looked at it. Then he turned his eyes to mine. I could see it. He put it together. Why we were really there, and what we were looking for. He nodded in understanding, straightened, and looked at Clarence.
You are not the only people to have lost someone in that fire. Nor are you alone in suspecting that the Black Veiled Prophet Society had a hand in it.
Do you know anything about that night?
I wasn't there.
His eyes moved from Rouse's to mine.
I lost someone special to me that night.
Who did you lose?
I'd rather not say.
I lost my big brother that night, and I would love nothing more than to get to the bottom of what happened that night. Anything you can tell us about that night is only going to help us get that much closer. It could lead us to also getting your son back to you safe.
Resolve building on his face, he nodded.
My father was a member of that society. Being a legacy, I was expected to join when invited. My sister, Claire, she was invited to the ball. She was there.
Price leaned against his desk, silent, lost in thought, then slowly started talking again.
Up until then, membership was very exclusive. That year, they changed their recruitment practices, opened up like never before. And all the prospective members perished, and they covered it up. I hate them.
I understand that.
I declined because of what they did, who they are. I want to protect my family, earn an honest living. I don't want to be beholden to some secret society who only understand power and control.
I know this is kind of a long shot, but I know a lot of higher society families frequently socialize with one another. Do you know the Heibergs?
Heiberg, the grocers?
Yeah, the Heibergs, Fred and Lenore.
I know of them.
Oh, you don't know them personally?
No.
I didn't know if perhaps they had been approached with a similar...
No. Oliver and many of the other members distrust Jews. They would never invite them.
Price's demeanor changed. He stood erect, straightening his suit. Then he moved toward the door, clearly indicating that our time was up.
Do you have a card so I can reach you if I discover more information?
I give him mine first.
And I'll take her card and write my number on the back of it.
Okay.
I can't afford no cards.
All right.
Thank you for stopping by and shedding some light on this.
What about the Millen family? His hand stopped just as it touched my card, and he looked up at me in surprise.
Millen? Brandon Millen is one of my closest friends.
So perhaps he was approached, declined, and received the same threat.
He was.
With total formality, he shook our hands and watched as the maid showed us out.
Thank you, Mr. Rouse. Miss Barnes?
Rouse and I hopped back in the cab. The next thing I really wanted to do before making our way back to the plaza was to follow up on the missing baby. That meant going back to Heidelberg's. Clarence gave the address and told the driver to step on it. Very shortly, we walked back into Heidelberg's Market and General Exchange. Frederick Heidelberg's eyes brightened with recognition as we approached.
Ah, Mr. Rouse, it's nice to see you again. Who's your lovely friend?
Julia Barnes with the Globe.
Oh.
I wanted to ask you a few questions about your daughter's disappearance kidnapping. The request caught Heidelberg off guard, but he quickly recovered, though his eyes did narrow in suspicion.
Sure. I suppose that would be all right.
I know you may not want to relive this again, but could you tell me all that you know? He turned his head, looking for someone. It was obvious that he didn't want his wife to overhear, likely to spare her the pain of having to relive it.
Her nanny was walking her in Lion Park. She would frequently take Sophia outside, weather permitting. The nanny fell ill, and people rushed to her aid, and during the confusion, someone took Sophia from a stroller.
What was the nanny's name?
Constance McKinney.
Heidelberg's mouth twitched as if the name of the nanny left a foul taste when he spoke it. Through gritted teeth, he took a deep breath before continuing.
No one was seen near the stroller. The police were summoned and the area was searched, but she was nowhere to be found. The investigating officer said that since there was no ransom demands, it was likely a despondent mother who'd recently lost a child.
How long has she been with you?
Well, she's no longer with us.
How long was she with you until then?
From the time of Sophia's birth.
She come recommended by somebody?
She was recommended by a friend of my wife's for whom she worked.
Who was the friend?
Anna Rice.
Anna Rice, is that any relation to Thomas Rice?
Thomas is her brother.
Who's her husband? What's the family?
A.J. Grant. Her legal name is Anna Grant, but she and my wife have been friends since they were children. Lenore still refers to her as Anna
Rice. Well, one more question.
All right. I gotta get prettied up.
Mr. Heidelberg, what do you know of the Black Veil Prophet Society?
I'm sorry, what?
Have you heard of that society?
The group that does the parade every summer?
Yeah, other than the parade.
No. Why do you ask?
I was just curious.
No reason.
I see. Okay.
Thank you for your time. Is there anything else you got, Julia? We've bothered this man enough. I'm going to drag her out of there.
Thank you. Thank you. Here's my card.
Father Leary and I arrived at the St. Louis University Library shortly after noon. We were to be met by Mary Dewey, one of Evan's assistants. She was a library science graduate student whom Leary trusted. My initial thought was that, considering the dark nature of the subject matter we were researching, it was odd that Evan would involve such a sweet girl. But he assured me that she was more than capable of dealing with it. She had assisted him with other projects of a sensitive nature. His emphasis on the word projects gave me pause. As a rule, Evan was very close-lipped about his role with the university and the Archdiocese. But something in Leary's eyes told me that they were not treading into unfamiliar territory. I shrugged and turned toward Mary as she approached from somewhere deeper in the library. From the way she moved, I could tell. Beneath her bookish exterior was a bearcat. I was suddenly keen with having her around.
Bless you, Mary. It's good to see you today.
It's good to see you, Father. What can I help you with?
We're here to look through the archives.
Anything in particular?
We need to make use of your Dewey Decimal System. The way she was doe-eyeing Evan, it was obvious that her interest in him wasn't merely academic. She was intoxicating. Shame she was so smitten. Evan, oblivious to Mary's attention, explained our situation and what we were looking for. Earlier, when we talked about Jönsson's Unaussprechlichen Kulten, I got the impression that he had encountered the work before. And at the mention of it, Mary seemed completely comfortable in looking for a work with such a dark reputation. On the other hand, at the mention of the torn page, which I kept folded in my notebook, she initially seemed confused. Then a look of delicious curiosity crossed her face.
That's a very odd request. May I see the page in question?
I opened my book and handed her the page. Her eyes lingered on it for a moment before looking up at me. Then to Evan, who stared back at her. It was a curious exchange, as if she were waiting for some signal from Leary, telling her that I could be trusted.
I give her a gentle smile and kind of shake it off like it's no big deal. I say, oh, we'll help you track down any relevant resources we might have on here.
If you say it's okay, Father, then follow me.
She turned and led us through the main library to a set of stairs in the back, then up to a private room on the third floor.
Make yourselves comfortable. I won't be a moment.
Thank you, Mary. We barely had time to settle ourselves before Mary turned with a worn black tome in her hands that she gently laid on the table. She smiled at me, no doubt at my amazement of a prompt retrieval of such a fabled work of dark lore.
From the restricted vault.
It's not an unusual thing for Father Leary to come in and start asking about some old book of weird lore and stuff.
In the hopes of putting her mind at ease, I reach into my jacket and I pull out a pair of white cloth gloves and I put them on.
What was the other work you wanted?
The People of the Monolith by Justin Jeffrey.
That should be in the casual reading section, I believe.
I'll see what I can do.
I very much appreciate it. It wasn't clear to me how long Evan and I had been studying the Yunt's work before Mary returned again, this time with a thin paper-bound book in her hand, which she set on the table next to Evan. A bright red nail tapped the cover.
You're in luck, Father. The Jeffrey's work was actually donated to us a few weeks ago.
Is there a bio on Jeffrey?
Not really. His poetry has been collected. Very little of it has been published, save his assorted poems books. Make a library use roll.
Okay.
That is on the nose.
30.
And you need?
40.
Both of you start looking at these books, looking at some of the other references. You spend about 4 hours in this.
And I'm making notes the whole time. I've got a leather-bound notebook. I'm making notes if there's any sketches or drawings or anything.
Sure.
I'm trying to reproduce them.
Mary sat down beside Evan as we immersed ourselves in uncovering what we could from the works before us. I focused my attention mostly on Yunt's. Some of the content of that book, things that had nothing to do with what we were looking for, but I saw as I perused it, still give me the creeps to this day. It wasn't until I reached the 11th chapter that I found something pertaining to what we needed. A reference to an ancient Hungarian tribe that worshipped a creature atop a black monolith. The description of the beast was vague, but it certainly was reptilian or amphibian in nature. The chapter also alluded to a lost city, stating that the wicked, beast-worshipping tribe were the devolved ancestors of the city's inhabitants. The name of the city, according to Yunt's, was Shultan, the same name used by Jeffrey in his poem.
When it says in the down a little bit further in the poem, it says, it isn't real. I wish it wasn't real. History so dark and profound. In Carpathian Basin, which I would assume would be Hungary, or Cahokian Mount. In Carpathian Basin, or Cahokian Mount. It's weird.
Mm-hmm.
As you're looking at the Unspeakable Cults is the translation. The very next chapter deals with a secret society that use idols of power, worshippers of a nameless god who use idols of power. And one of the idols that is described sounds very close to the stone statuette. A lot of things they talk about, the something watching vigil from its perch.
This toad symbolism is becoming more frequent the deeper we dig.
It's not a, as I've mentioned before, it's not a completely uncommon motif. Toads are found in every continent on Earth except Antarctica. Barry, could you give me your best volume on the Cahokia Mount?
Yes, certainly, Professor.
She stepped out as we continued our work. Leary cleared his throat, and I looked up at him. He was pointing to the open Jeffrey's work. I was so captivated in my own discoveries that I didn't register that he and Mary had found something important as well. I scanned the page he indicated, noting that page 166 was missing, and in fact, a perfect match with the page that Rouse found in Daly's pocket. Beyond the Unseen Gates. The name of the poem was Beyond the Unseen Gates. Anyway, when Mary returned, she set 3 more books down.
Actually, Professor, we have 3 books on Cahokia. 2 that deal with mounts, and 1 on the Mississippians. I took the liberty of fetching all 3 for you.
Oh, the more the merrier.
We're going to need some coffee.
I would prefer tea, thank you.
Go ahead and make your library use one more time.
29.
Okay.
Only needed 40.
Missed it.
Evan groaned in frustration and leaned back in his chair. I could tell what he was thinking, that we had found all that we needed to. I just wasn't so sure. Using his interruption as a cue to take a break, I sipped a tea that I never noticed Mary bring me. It had gone cold, but I drank it anyway. Picked up the book on the Mississippians and casually flipped through it. It was in the last chapter that I saw it. A reference to another lost city. Zooksall. In my excitement, I inadvertently slammed the open book on the table, eliciting a surprised squeak from Mary, who had become engrossed in the Jeffrey work.
There are some fringe archaeological circles that believe that Gokia Mounds and the surrounding city were built on the ruins of another city called Zooksall. But, they're filling in gaps that, taking leaps of faith that these things actually happened, but they really don't have any evidence for it. The archaeological evidence is not there.
That's a coincidence. I just read something about that. One of Jeffrey's last works. Here, titled Lost Zooksall.
Really?
She flipped to the end of the book and cleared her throat.
Into madness, tumble faster. Slave to unseen master. On belly I do crawl. Wretched worm to despise. God of mound do arise. In his buried hall. To old ones I appeal. Masking horror I feel. Before Lost Zooksall.
A cold chill ran down my spine. Jeffrey knew something. Lost cities, predating the Mississippians. Dark gods and their buried mounds. It was all too precise to be coincidence. We needed to know more about this, Jeffrey.
Mary, is there a phone I can use?
Yes, at the circulation desk.
Thank you.
I left Evan and Mary alone as I made my way downstairs. The girl at the circulation desk, a lovely dove named Pearl, handed me the phone with very little fuss.
Operator, need to make a long-distance call. Arkham, Massachusetts, Miskatonic University, Plinth, 529.
If there was someone who would know or could find out about an obscure poet, it was Arthur Webb, professor of literature at my alma mater.
Yeah, Webby.
Is that you, Smitty?
Yeah, I'm in St. Louis there, Webby. How are you? Is the connection good? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Hey, do me a favor there. I found a book of poems by a man named Justin Jeffries. I need a bio on him. I need to know where he's from, where he was, where he died. And by the way, are you related to a William Channing Webb?
Yes, he was my uncle.
Your uncle, he died March 9th?
Yes, he did.
Tell me, do you recall, I've heard of your uncle. I wasn't aware that you were related, but do you recall him coming to St. Louis in 1901?
The American Archaeological Society, yes.
Yeah, there was something about some disturbance about an idol relating to tribes in Greenland.
Yes, he spoke to me at length about that.
And he was ridiculed for it, if I recall.
By some, yes, but he was vindicated. A police inspector from New Orleans presented an idol to the society. The image was similar to the one that my uncle had seen among the degenerate Eskimos of Greenland.
A policeman from New Orleans vindicated him with an idol.
Yes. Up until that point, my uncle was seen as an eccentric adventurer, not taken very seriously by his peers.
What exactly was he saying? Could you explain that to me a little bit?
He visited the western shores of Greenland, where he witnessed all manners of degeneracy among a very singular tribe there. Dark stuff, abhorrent rituals, sacrifice and the like. The idol they presented was identical in style and form as that worshipped by the Eskimos, that the inspector claimed to have found it among devil-worshipping swamp people in Louisiana.
What shape did the idol take, exactly?
As I recall him saying, it was a grotesque crouching form on a platform.
A toad?
It could have been, sure.
Well, if you could find us a bio on Justin Jeffries, I would appreciate it.
Justin Jeffrey, I will see what I can do. Where can I reach you?
Father Leary's office at St. Louis University. It's Y-down 6728.
Okay. St. Louis, Y-down 6728. Got it. Justin Jeffrey. I'm not familiar with his work. This might take a while.
It's no problem there, Webby. I appreciate it.
I'll talk to you soon.
Toodaloo.
Julie and I return to the plaza to find Lockwood, finally awake, chatting with Dr. Covington in the hotel lounge. Finn looked surprised to see us, meaning it was unlikely that the doc had relayed the message of why we were meeting. That wasn't a shock. Covington was a pretty reserved guy. Probably didn't want to overstep himself.
Dr. Covington, Mr. Lockwood.
Good evening.
Dr. Covington, Finn.
You done saving the world?
We're getting closer, yes, sir.
That's wonderful.
You seem to like extravagant things. Guess where
I do?
I got us invited. Yeah, you're all hopped up about the plaza and how nice it was.
It is nice. It's very nice here. I don't stay in such digs, usually.
Well, I got us an invite to a dinner party at the Falstaff Mansion.
Why the hell would I want to go there with those people ever again in my life?
Well, sounds like a nice evening.
Don't worry, it's not in the case.
You weren't there. You don't know what you're talking about, lady. I don't care about those people. What are you doing here?
Well, we're working on investigating what happened that night. Also, yeah.
I told you what happened.
We were hired by Mr. Falstaff. You didn't tell me anything about what happened that night.
I told you exactly what happened that night.
No, you said it was crazy. A lot of crazy people.
Yeah.
And there's a guy blocking the door.
That's exactly what happened.
We want to know a little bit of what happened behind the scenes. That's what we're trying to find.
Mr. Falstaff's hired me and whomever I see fit to look into the construction going on at his house. He thinks there's something nefarious going on.
He doesn't know about the construction going on in his own house?
He knows it's happening. He also knows it looks suspicious.
White as a sheet, Finn's eyes were glazed in fear. He looked like he was about to be sick.
Mr. Lockwood, yes, you were interested in Dorian Daly.
I was?
Yeah, he wanted to go to his apartment.
Let's just give up Mr. Lockwood. He can do his own thing.
Don't listen to him. I don't know what his name is. Who is that guy?
It's Mr. Rouse.
Mr. Rouse.
Mr. Lockwood.
Yes.
You were interested in Dorian Daly and his apartment?
He was interesting. He was a disturbed man.
Sure.
That's your future, you know. You go down this rabbit hole, this is your future. The both of you.
My present is terrible. I'll take anything in the future.
Clearly. You need a shower. You smell like a hangover.
I think Mr. Falstaff and his mansion can hold equal interest for you. We believe that the key on Dorian Daly's key ring went to somewhere in the mansion.
Very wealthy man. A lot of hidden rooms.
We also have reason to believe that perhaps all of the shady business that's happening, or the presumed shady business that's happening with the Gedeki brothers, we think it might be tied to the fire that night, and also we might be able to figure it out.
The people in the fire. I would just rather put that behind me. Can you help me with that?
Julia nodded confidently, trying to still calm in Lockwood by the sheer force of will. I couldn't help but smile.
I'm trying to help you put it behind you, Mr. Lockwood.
Is the father going to come with us?
We hope so.
The father's invited. I can invite up to 8 people, whomever I want. I want the father and...
Mr. Smith.
I'll go with
Jack Houston Smith.
I'll go with you as long as the father is with us.
Well...
The father will be there. I spoke with him earlier.
I hope you know what you're getting yourselves into.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you have enjoyed this episode of the Stygian Fragment. Please check for further episodes posted on our website, gamerstable.com. Theme music by Thomas Grillo. Background music by Musica Cthuliana. Openly Gamer Theater would like to thank H.P. Lovecraft for giving us Cthulhu. Any commercial use of this production is prohibited. Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium Incorporated. Openly Gamer Theater is trademark property of Side Tangent Productions.